Hi. Oh, sorry if this sounds weird, but are you actively eating that candy bar? Maybe you could throw it to me.
I need you here now.
Hi, Bruce. Yes, I'm coming.
Bruce, I discovered that I could travel in time. And in doing so, I destroyed the timeline.
Love you, Bob.
I love you too.
But I will fix it.
What now?
I got you.
Why did you help me?
Because you needed help.
I will help you fight love.
You want to get nuts? Let's get nuts.
Wait, he's Batman?
This world must die.
No! If you went back and changed the past.
Are you ready?
Ready. You changed the future.
No matter what we do, we're not going to be able to fix this.
No! Nobody die!
Let's go.
Hey, what's going on, everybody? How you guys doing? Welcome back to another episode of Podio Commentary. My name is Matt Jarboe, and tonight we are going to be talking about a movie that has had a lot of problems. It's had a lot of tumultuous attempts to get done, to get on the screen, but now that it's finally here and it's finally on home video, at least digital, we can talk about The Flash. We can talk about the movie and really go through it and look at it from what I'd like to argue is a relatively critical angle. And also one that I need to change my own approach on, and one that I need to change my own viewpoint on. Because after having just watched it again, I've largely softened to things that I was critical about the first time. And now I'm looking at it from the lens of, damn it, son of a bitch. It would be great if we got more, but I can understand absolutely why we're not going to get it. So let's talk about The Flash. So the synopsis here is that Barry Allen is a crime scene investigator who gains superhuman speed after being struck by lightning. When a terrorist attack strikes his city, Barry becomes a superhero known as The Flash. He soon discovers that he has the ability to time travel and goes back to save his mother's life. And in doing so, ends up changing everything. And he's not wrong. It's not only does it change everything in regards to his character arc or change everything in regards to the world around him, it changes everything in regards to how we perceive and how we view and how we look at the DCEU, because now it's all gone. But there's a whole story about how this movie came to be, because it's not one that that happened quickly. In fact, it took damn near a decade for this film to even remotely come out. But before we dive into all that, we do need to talk a little bit about, you know, the writer of the movie. And if you know me, you guys know that I'm not the biggest fan of Christina Hodson. You know, she also wrote Birds of Prey, and she wrote Bumblebee, which I think is not a great movie, but when I do a Podio commentary on that one, I'll rewatch it, and who knows, maybe like this, my views will soften a little bit. And of course, she also wrote the unreleased, canceled Batgirl movie. And she will soon be doing the upcoming Fast and Furious 11. I don't know how that's going to go, but it's going to be definitely something there we're talking about when it does, especially if you've seen Fast 10 and you know how it ends. Cliffhangers are always, you know, a fun time to end movies with, right? But here in this particular movie, Christina Hodson ended up receiving the sole screenplay credit, but the story credit went to John Francis Daly and Jonathan Goldstein, who were the previous writers and directors on the project before Andy Muschietti came on board. And these guys were known for Game Night that came out in 2018, as well as writing Spider-Man Homecoming, and they directed the recent surprise, you could call it a surprise, Dungeons and Dragons. They did that one, and a lot of people out there really, really, really love Dungeons and Dragons. So those guys had written it. The story, she ended up adapting the story and probably doing a lot to change the dialogue. And I have a feeling you can, when you watch the movie, there's a lot with the dialogue that I find to be even now, still kind of annoying. But what she nails really well is the heart. I think she nailed the heart really well. I think she nailed what she was going for with the story really well. But also, I was like, okay, there's some of the jokes or some of the lines that I don't really feel did as well as they could. Also, there were a lot of other people that had worked on this as well. You had Seth Graham Smith, who had written a draft a long time ago. Rick Famuyiwa had written a draft and was going to direct. And even at one point in time, Ezra Miller themselves had teamed up with Grant Morrison, of all people, and decided to go and work on a screenplay for this movie in order to get their vision of The Flash out there, because it was in development hell. It was just straight up in development hell. They only had 2 weeks to eke out a script, and clearly that's not what we got. Also, Joby Harold, who wrote Army of the Dead for Zack Snyder, had contributed to drafts of The Flash. I think he also worked on Kenobi, and I think he is also writing Rebel Moon for Zack Snyder. So there's a lot of people who have contributed to this story. Even Jeff Johns at one point, because this is largely based on Flashpoint, his Flash story. Even Phil Lord and Chris Miller from Spider-Verse and 21 Jump Street and, you know, the original cut of Solo. They even chimed in trying to make this movie happen. So that goes to show you how long and how just how long it took for this movie to even remotely get itself done, to even remotely get itself out there. And it's wild to think that what we got was probably so vastly different from what they wanted to do in the first place, because the movie was directed by Andy Muschietti. But again, this guy who we know largely from It Chapter 1, It Chapter 2, as well as Mama from 2013, you know, he came on in and he was able to see it done and able to get it over the finish line and get it onto screens. But even he was not the first person that they wanted to have directed. I think, again, Rick Famuyiwa, Phil Lord, Chris Miller, John Francis Daly, and Joshua Goldstein, those guys were going to also direct it. I mean, so many people were involved in trying to get this movie done, and it literally just took them forever to kind of settle on Andy. And I really like his work. Again, after watching the movie again, I really feel like he brought a lot of heart, a lot of love, and a lot of kind of like Looney Tunes-esque humor to the role, which I don't know if that kind of like juxtaposes some of the stuff that, you know, the rest of the movie, again, like talking about like the way the dialogue was written, the way some of the jokes were written felt very Acme-ish, felt very Looney Tunes-ish. But at the same time, there was like a tender underbelly to the movie. And I really feel like Michael Keaton did a great job. You know what I mean? Everyone actually did a really, really, really good job. I was really surprised with how much I enjoyed everyone's performance in the movie. And that only kind of adds to like the bittersweetness when the movie's over and you're like, hey, it's over. Great. Yeah. Awesome. Great. Perfect. Amazing. It's over. And now we're just never going to get it again. But let's talk about the script itself, because that is probably my largest point of contention outside of the visual effects, which I kind of understand a little bit better now than I did before. But I want to talk about how Christina Hodson ended up like approaching the writing of this movie. So she was brought on board in 2019. So this is after Birds of Prey was already shot. This is after Bumblebee had come out. You know, she was still kind of making a name for herself, everything else. She actually came on for a page one rewrite after John Francis Daly and Joshua Goldstein had left the project. She just came on and everything else. And she decided to do a page one rewrite, but based on their story. And I really think they wanted to tackle like a lot more of like the humorous elements of it. Like they really, I think those guys were more of the nerds that were bringing up like the Back to the Future jokes and, you know, referencing other things here and there. Like there's the scene in the movie where, Ezra Barry steals beer by phasing into his neighbor's house and then pulling out some beers and coming back, going through a Raquel Welch poster, the same poster from Shawshank Redemption, which I thought was a little bit on the nose in regards to that, but like it is just very much like a reference. And what's even funnier is Ezra's controversies. The one that finally got Ezra in trouble was actually Ezra stealing beer from a friend, from a neighbor. Kind of funny how art imitates life to an extent on that one. But still, it is, you know, it is what it is. But as they were working on the movie, you had her work really closely with Andy to craft the story and the vision of the film. Then you had she tried to balance the multiverse story with everything else. And part of me wonders about the multiverse story, because was that like a Walter Hamada edict? Was that a Toby Emmerich edict? Because, you know, they were trying to make that at the time. They'd already gone through so many issues and so many problems with getting the Snyderverse off the ground and having that kind of come to a head. And they were really wanting to build up to something that they could rival Marvel with. But, you know, and honestly, when it comes to that stuff, DC has the multiverse. We know about the multiverse. So it becomes a really interesting look at that, because you could see that's what they were building towards with this story, but they still had to alter it from Flashpoint to make it more of like a familial story that has its basis in emotion, right? Because the ending of the movie, despite everything, is really emotional. Like, it is. It's really, really, really emotional. And I got choked up watching it in the theater. And tonight when I was watching it, my girlfriend, she got choked up at the end of the movie because of how it was, of how it felt, you know, the emotions that went for it and everything else. So, you know, Christina Hodson did do some good stuff there with those emotional scenes, but I think the comedy was forced. And I say that because even going back and watching Birds of Prey, or like the comedy in that movie was so remarkably forced that it just took away from, like, I'm sorry. The egg sandwich scene is still so stupid in my opinion. No matter how many times I go back and look at that movie, through even a fonder lens, that scene still just irks me. And that feels like that is Christina Hodson's level of comedy. And I don't really feel that it works. But she was trying, so that's good. Hodson here also gave more screen time and depth to female characters like Iris West and Nora Allen. I mean, did Iris West need to even be in the movie? That's a whole other question, which we'll talk about down the road. Nora did a good job. The actress who played her did a really good job conveying that warm mom approach and loving her kids. And I think that really sells it. And then honestly, according to some of the research I found, they think that Christina Hodson's rewrite brought more heart and humor compared to earlier drafts. I'm gonna definitely agree with the heart. But I don't know if I'm going to agree with the humor. I don't think the humor was necessarily there. But I am kind of curious what Andy brought to the table, what he wanted to do when it came to making the movie, right? So, I mean, really, honestly, when he came on in, there was like the visual spectacle that he wanted to maintain. You know, he aimed to create an epic visual experience using his horror background to bring striking imagery to the superhero action. And it's funny because, like, I feel like I can understand that to some extent, you know, with the opening scene with the Snyderverse crowd and then getting into some of the other action stuff with like Batman at the base in Serbia. And then obviously the final set piece, those were like, I don't know if I would personally say that those were kind of bathed in horror, but they were definitely comic booky and they were definitely great. Like, I know I complained originally about how the opening 15, 20 minutes of the movie had like the albatross of the Snyderverse around its neck and the baby scene still whatever. But after watching it again and even rewatching just the opening of it again last night before I sat down with the family, the opening really kind of softened on me. And I really enjoyed Ben Affleck, his portrayal of Batman. I really enjoyed seeing that again, especially Jeremy Irons and Gal Gadot, you know. And the only person that didn't make an appearance in the movie was Ray Fisher's Cyborg. And we know why Ray Fisher's Cyborg didn't make it in the movie. So there's that, right? We know why Ray Fisher's Cyborg did not make it in the movie. Also, you know, one of the things he wanted to do was like really put character focus on Barry Allen's personal relationships and emotional journey with dealing with the childhood trauma and grief. And I feel that is something that they really nailed. Obviously, you know, Barry was dealing with all of these things. And I feel like Barry, before going back in time, didn't understand the gravity of the situation, because he's kind of, you know, he was forced to grow up, but that made him kind of cold and also unsure of himself to an extent. But then when he had to kind of mentor younger Barry, you could see him take on like a leadership role. You could see him take on like a mentor, a bigger brother role, and obviously being very selfless about it in the interim. And I thought that worked out pretty well. I mean, obviously another thing that Andy wanted to bring to the table is fan service, because you kind of have to in these movies. And I think they did a pretty decent job of creating an enjoyable, you know, you could argue rewatchable experience with a lot of heart and spectacle. And I can agree with that statement right there. But does this movie honor the DC legacy? Because that's also part of it as well. It has to honor what came before it, whether that is recent or whether that is older. You know, like, this movie is largely based around Justice League from 2017, with one brief mention of the Snyder Cut from 2021. And again, it lives in this place that a lot of people just don't quite know. You know what I mean? And so it is very much one of those odd scenarios with the movie as a whole. But anyway, moving on here. So let's talk about the filming of the movie, because once everything was kind of put together, everything was ready to go, they finally got the movie off the ground April 19th, 2021 at the Warner Brothers Studios in Leavesden, England. So they shot the movie around Burleigh House and St. Paul's Cathedral in London, as well as Edinburgh, Glasgow, and other locations around the UK. Glasgow actually was where they shot Gotham City stuff, and also certain things with Michael Keaton's Batman. If I recall, Glasgow was also where they filmed the original Batman, which made it really kind of feel like that, which I thought worked out really well. The movie itself filmed for about 3 months, from April to July 2021, with additional photography taking over September 2021 to October 2021 for action sequences. And there were some pickup shoots that were done in 2022 during the post-production side of things. And that was the post-production side of things is really where the Ezra Miller controversy took hold. And when that happened, obviously, like, it put a lot of things in there. You know what I mean? Like, it kind of messed things up a little bit. But when they got the movie done and they finally were getting ready to come out, despite all the delays and all the shuffling and everything else, they did what I think is probably one of the stupidest things they could have done in regards to this movie. And that, unfortunately, guys, is all the fan screenings. Even with everything that had happened with Ezra Miller and all the controversy surrounding Ezra Miller and all the arrests and the public apology and all of the comments and conversations from the studio heads and the other actors about how Ezra is getting help and Ezra is getting better. I mean, there's a lot of people that think that the failure of this movie rests firmly on Ezra's shoulders. I think it has a lot to do with a lot of different factors. I think having so many movies out in June, the fact that it opened on June 16th, 2023, up against Elemental, The Blackening, Extraction 2 on Netflix. I mean, there was a lot that was eating in to that particular box office. And then even though nothing really came out the next weekend, I think you had that Ruby Gilmore movie, it just still failed to really connect. Spider-Verse ended up coming back in and kicking its ass in that second weekend after The Flash came out. You know, and it just, like, the movie just did not have legs. It just did not survive. And again, a lot of people put that on Ezra Miller. My take's a little bit different. My take is that it actually had more to do with the fan screenings. I think the fan screenings for that movie really, really hurt it. And let me explain why. So first off, they were touting the whole thing. They were going to show the movie at, you know, CinemaCon 2023. They were going to show like 99% of the movie. They weren't going to show everything because not all the visual effects were done, but the people there were going to be able to watch practically everything. And the thing is, though, you know, there's kind of a bleak ending of the movie. You know, the theatrical cut of the film, there's a bleak ending of the movie. We know what was originally going to be shot was going to be this, big kind of like setup for Crisis, right? Where you had Batman leading the Justice League, played by Michael Keaton. Wonder Woman was going to be there. Henry Cavill, Superman, was going to be there. Supergirl was going to be there. And The Flash was going to be there. And we know that that was what they were trying to do to build up to a Crisis movie. But then they also didn't want people to walk away from the ending of that movie by thinking, man, like Batman and Supergirl are just going to die. Right. Like they wanted it to be more of a hopeful ending, wanted it to be more of a happy things are going to continue sort of thing. But then through the power of reverse osmosis, what we have here is a movie that largely ends with the two, you know, the big draws outside of the Flash, especially Keaton's Batman, both dying in a fulcrum event or a canon event, if you want to approach it from the logic that Across the Spider-Verse used. And then it just really wasn't like the best of endings. It was like, everyone's going to die. Nothing I can do. I got to go back. And I feel like when I'm thinking about that specifically, it's just like, yeah, the fan screenings, especially the one from CinemaCon, the one that had like the positive glowing reviews that this is the best DC movie, like all the hype surrounding it, it didn't have that dark, dreary ending. It had the original ending that people, no one saw, but that's what it was building up to. So the mood of the movie was absolutely building up to that. And that ends up being kind of the weirder thing, in my opinion. It has everything to do with the fact that it's like the people at CinemaCon saw something that simply, ultimately, 2 months later, didn't exist. They saw an entirely different ending or a setup for a different ending that was more hopeful. That was more what people want out of DC. And then they, you know, kept changing, brought in George Clooney and did that whole thing as a way to kind of wrap it up a little bit or to leave it very open-ended, but to still largely wrap it up. And I just think that they kind of lied to the people of CinemaCon, if I'm my honest take on that one. But not only that, they did fan screenings, not even fan screenings. They did free screenings everywhere. And I mean everywhere. Like when I was sitting there and I'm watching this movie, you know, or jokes I was making before the movie came out was like, if you want to see this movie early, all you got to do is just look around. There's more than enough free screenings to go to. And lo and behold, two friends of mine, both from different parts of the country, not LA or New York or really major cities, both ended up going to see early screenings in their city. Why did they do this? They did this because they wanted to build word of mouth. They wanted people to come out of this movie just like they did at CinemaCon and sell it. They wanted the audience to sell it. And they did a really good job with that, in my opinion, except they just kept having too many free screenings. And at the end of it, when the movie came out, everyone who wanted to see the movie, well, they went to go see the movie for free. And they didn't bring back their friends and family. They didn't come back a second time. And I think a lot of that has to do with the fact that there wasn't that much of a hopeful ending for the movie to bring you back for more. The same Universal had the same problem in 2010 with Scott Pilgrim versus the World. They did so many free screenings of that movie, hoping to boost the hype for that film and the conversation for that movie, that by the time that movie came out in theaters, anyone who wanted to see it had already seen it. And I saw the movie twice in theaters, but I worked for theaters at the time, so I saw it for free. But I did buy it on Blu-ray. And as a result, a lot of people found Scott Pilgrim on home video after the fact, and now it's a cult classic that recently turned, you know, 10 years old, right? I think, oh no, that was 2000. I forget when that one came out, 2010, 2011. But either way, it's like, that's what I'm talking about here, is these studios, like, they marketed the movie horribly. And I think Warner Brothers does that as well, because the downside to that is when the movie finally released on June 16th, never mind the completely fully loaded theater, or movie theaters at the time with everything else to watch, it still failed to connect. And when I went to my free screening, I had a bit of issues with that as well. Like, there was stuff I liked about it, but I was really just kind of bogged down from the opening 20 minutes of the movie. I think largely, and I'll be honest with you guys, largely for me, it was because I'm a big fan of Zack Snyder. I'm a big fan of those characters and those actors playing those characters, that like going back and seeing it one more time was just kind of like, it was bittersweet, but it also was maybe a little bit annoying because it was like, this is not what I wanted. This is not what I wanted. I know it's over. I know we're not going to get more. No, it's not going to be sold to Netflix. I know all these things are happening, but it still sucks because I'm thinking to myself, like, this is what I would just love to see more of. And then I felt like Ezra was also like the really like the opening of the movie. Ezra was just like the worst. And even now watching it again, I still don't think that the Barry at the beginning of the movie is the same Barry that we got when they go back, you know, to 2013. Right. And I know that's largely meant to be the, you know, the character progression, the hero's journey, if you will. But it still ultimately to me feels like just two completely different characters. And that's okay. That's okay. Cause it still works for me, you know, like, so to talk about the film itself, like the movie has the solid opening. Obviously you've got Ben Affleck as Batman having that great action scene. We all want more, you know, Batman. The audio when I saw the movie in the theater was definitely not mixed right, because it was very difficult to hear Ben Affleck. Here it was better to hear Ben Affleck. It was a little easier to hear his performance, but still, like, it was a little on the muffled side. So I don't know if that was just something that happened with the movie that they fixed before the home video release. But it was still really cool to watch all of that play out in the middle of the day. And he even, like, had, like, you know, it was Falcone's kid that, you know, Alfred was absolutely right about everything, usually happens. You know, and like, it just felt like you're watching kind of like what the Batman, the Batfleck movie would have been. And to me, that's the one thing I wanted to see more of. I just really wanted more of that. And so then, you know, a little bit later on when Barry's having a conversation with Bruce about going back and saving his mom or saving Bruce's parents. And there's a whole line there about, like, you know, this is what defines us. This is what makes us who we are. You know, and he's like, yeah, but, like, you know, I can fix it. And he's all like, you know, yeah, but, like, that's not going to make you better. You know, that's not going to like solve any issues. It can destroy everything. But then, of course, you know, Barry's got the idea. Go back. I'm just going to go put a can of tomatoes in a cart, and I'm just going to save my mom's life. And that was one of the most interesting little tidbits, because this movie heavily relies on the tropes created by Back to the Future 2. Like, we can be fair about that. We can be honest about that. This movie, and this might be like the John Francis Daley, Joshua Goldstein part, I don't quite know, but they heavily, heavily relied on what people's knowledge of time travel is from Back to the Future. You know, and I get that for, like, hey, this is a pop culture movie and we need to, like, reference other pop culture. Even Avengers Endgame, when talking about time travel through the quantum realm, still heavily referenced Back to the Future Part 2. You know, there's the whole alternate 1985 moment with Batman at the Wayne Manor. They do a lot to really reference all that stuff. And it doesn't bother me. Like, I get it. From like a normie perspective, I get it. This is the type of movie that you need, that you're going to have a lot of people who don't probably who are not going to want to go into, like, the quantum physics idea of what, you know, time travel is, right? Right. There's a lot of people that are just not going to want to do that. And so they need to find a way to sell it and convey it. And they did. And I thought it worked out all right. The spaghetti example that Bruce gives, Batman gives, for how the multiverse works, I thought was really, well, it was good. I thought it was really good, really compelling, because it's just, it explains it in such a way where you can kind of go, oh yeah, I get it. Because, like, I've eaten spaghetti. I understand that stuff runs parallel, but there's parts that overlap. It ends up kind of doing its own thing. What they probably didn't explain very well was why all of the other universes were colliding into one. You know, especially because, like, when we meet, like, Dark Flash towards the end of the movie, when, you know, he reveals that he's been doing this for a lifetime, he's older, he's disfigured, he's become a complete shadow of his former self while trying to save the people that he cares about. Largely, it's like, we still don't know why that happened. And they didn't do enough to explain why we needed Cameo City. You know what I mean? And to me, that's kind of the bigger part of that, because the cameo stuff was interesting, but that was the fan service. That was like, oh, hey, look, George Reeve, or George Reeves, you know, oh, Adam West, there's Christopher Reeve and Helen Slater. And then there's, you know, oh, look, there's Nick Cage as Superman with the gigantic black spider. Ah, Kevin Smith is cream in his jeans and stuff. Like, we know that they did all that for cameo purposes. And what I find to be really funny is, and I said this when I saw the movie too, go back and watch Ready Player One and go look at the opening of Ready Player One when they're describing the Oasis and they go through all the different, like, you know, planets, the universes, and then go and look at that and then look at what they did visually for The Flash. And it's like, okay, same studio. I think someone just got lazy, to be honest with you. And they're like, hey, that concept works. Let's just do that and throw that in there. That was probably, like, I would argue, like, the worst part of the film overall. Even without the babies, like, that was, like, probably the worst part of the film. But what I will tell you what I liked. I liked Sasha Kale. I liked Supergirl. I enjoyed her little storyline. I really enjoyed, again, the whole scene going to the base in Siberia, going to Russia, getting to do all the Batman stuff, getting more with Keaton as Batman. And then, obviously, having her be there and be the different type of character than Clark was, but still ultimately believing in the same thing. And having those little interactions. And I would, again, it's one of those things where it's like, these movies, these worlds do really well when they start to build up how you look at them, right? Like the interaction in regards to these multi movies, right? To these, you know, cinematic universes, these characters interact. That's what we want to see. And seeing these characters, I would love to see them interact with other characters. I think that'd be a lot of fun. That was kind of the biggest downside at the end of the movie, was like, oh, great. Like, they're not coming back. They are dead. They are dead in the universe that Barry, that he left. He went back. He took out the can of tomatoes. He put it back on the shelf. And then he changed it to where his dad looked up. A little subtle change that saved his dad from going to jail, but largely... or saved his dad from spending the whole life in jail, really. But then largely after that, ended up just being in this, like, it just, again, changing who Batman is. We don't know what else in the world has changed. Subtle changes, you know, butterfly effect, yield really crazy negative results and stuff. So to kind of wrap up talking about the movie itself, there was a lot of really good stuff there. I think the musical score was good. I do like the cameo scene, even though it does, the CG wasn't great. The Chrono Bowl was kind of stupid, but... the shot of at the end of it when Barry runs back to go and return everything to normal, and you just see him running and younger Barry ends up just getting covered by the sands of time. I really liked that. I just enjoyed that scene a lot. And then, of course, the scene in the grocery store with his mom and kind of having that goodbye was really nice and really sweet and everything. I thought that was pretty fantastic. But another thing I thought was really good about the movie was just, like, it was long, but it was paced pretty well. And I think it flowed really well, and it flowed better the second time, and you could notice a lot more. And while there are a lot of really goofy elements in the film, there are quite a bit of things that probably could have been changed to be maybe a little bit darker or a little bit more serious. Like the scene when they're talking with, like, the friends in the apartment, and it's the two jerks that he works with at the crime lab, and then Gary with Marty McFly. That was so dumb. I understand the purpose of the scene is to just kind of talk things out and to showcase that, oh, it's different here, right? It's different here. Here it's, you know, it's not Michael J. Fox, right? It's Eric Stoltz. Like, oh, okay. You know, in this world, Arthur Curry didn't get born, but, you know, okay, whatever, right? And so we end up having... that, and that to me is just kind of like, those are the scenes that kind of drag it down. The scenes where it's trying too hard to be funny is where it kind of loses me. But I'll tell you what, though. I mean, the critics, on the other hand, they felt maybe a little bit like me. I mean, it makes mixed reviews from critics. A lot of them praised its humor, its action sequences, and the performances, but heavily criticized the visual effects of the third act, which I mean, looking at it again, there are some problems with that third act, obviously, in regard to the visuals when fighting Zod and everything else. However, Rotten Tomatoes, does show the film holding an approval rating of 64% based off of 354 reviews. So it wasn't like reviewers didn't go out and see this movie. But like I said before, the big factor here is that these critics, they all got to see it for free. The movie was out tons of screenings. It wasn't even a problem. The critical consensus of Rotten Tomatoes says that The Flash is funny, fitting, fast-paced, and overall ranks as one of the best DC films in recent years. Metacritic gave it a weighted score of 56 out of 100, And then the audiences on CinemaScore gave it a B on a scale of A plus to F, which is, you know, usually about kind of what horror movies get. However, it was tied with what Batman v Superman got back in 2016. And both of those films hold the lowest grade for any movie in the DCEU. So that's kind of funny. You know, it's kind of like the problems began in Batman v Superman, and they kind of culminated with this one a little bit. What you also got is really not the best take home for the box office. The box office pulled in worldwide $267.2 million against a production budget of roughly $220 million, not including marketing. But again, as I've mentioned before, and I'll just mention it again, when you have tax incentives will and rebates will largely reduce the cost of that. Is this movie going to be profitable with only $106 million domestic and $160.4 million worldwide? The answer to that is no. The answer to that is no. It just is not going to be profitable unless it does very well on VOD and everything else. And it might. I mean, Black Adam, 3 weeks number one, you know, didn't hit $400 million worldwide, 393, but it spent like, I think, 2 weeks at the top of Apple's VOD charts. And I don't know where it sold on the home video charts, but, you know, I mean, these, you know, we do know that these movie studios do quite well from the PVOD. And so that is offsetting the amount of money lost at the theater. So that's something there to consider. So then the question then becomes, well, what happens next, right? Like, what does happen next? Well, we did hear that back in October of 2022, there was a script for a sequel that had been written by David Leslie Johnson McGoldrick, who wrote the Aquaman films. And even in the event The Flash performed well, they would get the sequel. And it also apparently included more of Keaton's Batman and Kal-El's Supergirl. But this was also right around the time that The Rock was pushing those Henry Cavill cameos at the end of the movies. So they were writing it for Henry Cavill to be back as Superman, which means it would have done the original ending of The Flash, by having everyone still alive. But largely right now, Warner Brothers is not expected to retain Ezra Miller for future films because of the actor's controversies and legal issues, even though they're open to working with Ezra again, largely, I would assume at this point, because the movie has a greater, well, is seen as a greater flop than, let's say, Green Lantern in 2011, probably not. James Gunn, on the other hand, has got some weird stuff with this movie. You know, he was out there calling it the best superhero movie ever. He loves the movie. He was very much hyping it up. But he also confirmed that this movie would reset the continuity of the DCEU alongside with Aquaman and The Lost Kingdom, which are then going to lead into the DCU's first movie, Superman Legacy. And then Andy Muschietti has also been hired to direct Batman Brave and the Bold, or just Brave and the Bold, for DC Studios, which is coming probably earliest 2026, 2027, provided that the writer strike and the actor strike finish up pretty quick. But the question then becomes, who's going to be playing with these characters? I don't quite know. Hopefully one day we'll be able to get a full Justice League movie, a full Flash reboot, and everything will be gravy. But in the meantime, we're left with a whole bunch of what ifs. We're left with a whole bunch of, wow, that's interesting. Too bad it failed the way that it did. And now we go into the part of the show that I actually am the most excited about, and that's getting your guys' thoughts. So let me just drop the StreamYard link once more, and let's bring in David Steele. David, how's it going? David.
Yeah, we go. Sorry about that. I'm good, thank you. How are you?
I'm doing well, thank you. So what are your thoughts on The Flash?
So I actually, when I first saw it, I was really, really critical for a lot of different reasons. But, I've kind of taken a couple steps back, and I think there were a lot of problems with the film. One of them you brought up was fan screenings. I thought, I love the Keaton thing. This happened. This film really relied on its nostalgia.
It did.
Michael Shannon wasn't too thrilled being back, but you know, I mean, he did it for a paycheck. I mean,
well, I don't mind him doing it for a paycheck. I don't mind actors. You know, actors have got to work, right? So, like, coming back for a paycheck is absolutely fine. Affleck came back probably for a paycheck and also to say goodbye to the character. Gal Gadot probably came back because they were like, look, we want you in these cameos, but we're working on Wonder Woman 3, so we just want to keep you in the loop. But now that means nothing because right before this movie came out, we found out that they had, you know, moved on from Patty Jenkins, so they're not doing Wonder Woman 3 and everything else. And it's really, like, interesting when you start looking at, like, all the stuff that this movie was promising or things around this movie were promising, and even leading up to, like, the whole thing with Gunn taking over last year, it felt like things are going a completely different direction that ended up just really not being true. And now we're kind of stuck in this space of, I almost want to say purgatory. When it comes,
I was going to say limbo,
limbo, purgatory. When it comes to like these characters, because you know, I, like many of the other fans, want to see more, but I'm also way more realistic about wanting to see more. And when I'm watching this movie, as much as I enjoyed it a lot more the second time, like, you know, because I'll tell you how you know I like a movie, right? So I sit down to watch it, and I'm like, okay, I got to like be critical of it. I got to watch it again. And then my girlfriend's like, do you want popcorn? And I'm like, no, I don't want popcorn. You know, I just want to watch the movie. And then, like, she's making popcorn and I'm getting into watching it. And I'm like, yeah, give me a bowl. You know, like, let me. And I kick back in my chair and I'm just like eating my popcorn and whatnot and enjoying the movie. And like that for me was a big indicator. Like now I'm in it. I'm in watching this movie. And that then becomes a greater, like a greater sadness on my soul when it gets to the very last shot there of like when Ben is talking to Ezra. And Ben just goes, you know, like, hey, not this time or some other time. And then gets in the car and drives away. You're like, that's the last time we're going to see Ben Affleck as Batman, you know. And like that is a very bittersweet thing because I've always enjoyed his portrayal of the character and everything else. And then you're watching the movie and you're like, it's like you just kind of know where it's going. It's a lot of fun to get there. But even at the very end when, like, Keaton is dying and Ezra's like, you know, we can bring you back. And he's like, no, you already did. But no, this is it. And it's like, that's just such a downer thing.
Yeah, you don't want to really, you want to have closure, but you don't want to, you know, end the movie and say, okay. I mean, you want some resolution and be like, you know, you want it to end on a happy note, but it's like, and you want to have closure, but you don't want to bum the audience out and say, oh,
no, and
this is your ending and oh, and that's it.
Well, and like, I really do feel that to some extent that is also what bums I think that is what's going to bum the audience out, as I think you get to the ending of that movie and it's like you're the heroes you spent the time with, the heroes you built the connection with, they're dead. And at the end, with their original ending, we've seen behind the scenes photos of this. Keaton and Sasha Kaye, they were alive, right? At the end, Supergirl and Batman, they were alive at the end of the movie when they're on the courthouse outside of everything. And then they get rid of that. They bring in Clooney, which I thought the Clooney thing was fun, you know, but it was also just like, what the hell? You know, like it's just now it's like now there's nothing to look forward to. Because you know that it's over. And it's like now all these characters, this entire universe is stuck in limbo. And it's just like, this is where I'm really like, you know, with Comic-Con being this week, part of me is like, just can someone just announce a freaking graphic novel to wrap this thing up? You know, can we just wrap it up and then be done with it?
Yeah, closure.
Yeah, it's... Yeah. Yeah, I mean, and I agree with Ralph there in the chat. Films have to have consequences. I completely agree, and I feel like they have such this weird get out of jail free card for it, because all they have to say is just we're rebooting because we don't have the money.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know. I mean, it gets to the point where it's like you want these things to be a success, and I think that was the other thing too. Like this movie had been. In talk about in limbo, this had been in limbo for almost 2.5-3 years.
Longer, I mean, this than, that. Was Longer supposed, than that.
Yeah, and it was like the anticipation was there, and we were all excited for it. And I mean, like I said, there were a couple of things. You talked about the fan screenings. You had, it was right in the middle of June. I mean, literally right in the middle. So you had all these other films coming out.
Well, you know, one thing I didn't touch upon here, and this is always interesting, is the fact that the movie was announced in 2014, the week after the Flash TV show premiered, right? The week after it premiered, they announced this DCEU lineup with Ezra Miller as the Flash. You know, that was announced. And then the movie comes out a couple weeks or so after the show ends. So 9 years later, 9 seasons of Grant Gustin as the Flash, that fans of that show, of that character, are going to watch and love. And then people go see the movie and it's not Grant Gustin. So part of me is like, look, I get it. I understand the idea of not wanting to, you know, of like having your movie character and having your TV actor.
You're separate.
But they've crossed over before, and there wasn't even a Grant Gustin reference or cameo in this movie. When it's like, but like, you brought back Christopher Reeve, but you can't do a Grant Gustin cameo. Like what the hell's going on here? I know the Arrowverse has gone downhill in regards to quality, but there's still a lot of fans of the Arrowverse, especially of the Flash show, because that was the last man standing. That was the second Arrowverse show, and it was the last man standing at the end. So it clearly had the longest continuous run and the most fan support. But no, I mean, just like whatever with it. Just, you know, do not. That's one of the things that really got, that really bugged me about that, was they just didn't embrace it. And I feel like that's where the movie has one of its major flaws. Like, if you're embracing all of these other universes, but you can't embrace the one that people actually know and like and want to see, then that shows a really, really, really strong lack of leadership. And I don't know if that particular scene was shot. I don't know if they shot it in secret. I don't know if it was planned, but just couldn't come through because of COVID or because of just, you know, scheduling issues, so on and so forth. But remember, Ezra popped up in 2019 for Crisis. So Ezra made an appearance, and that's where Ezra got the name The Flash, was in Crisis.
Oh, okay.
You know,
that's interesting.
So it's like they were already trying to establish continuity. And if you go back to the very first DC fandom in 2020, there was a whole panel with Greg Berlanti and Walter Hamada, and I want to say Jim Lee, and they did a whole hour on like the 101 of the multiverse. And this was just a few months after Crisis had premiered on CW, that whole crossover. And I'm like looking at that going like, yeah, clearly they want to build towards Crisis theatrically. And then even the next year at Fandom 2021, they had a whole thing with Jim Lee talking about Crisis, and you're like, oh, this is clearly what they're going towards. But again, that plan shot to space, jettisoned, right? Just forgotten about, gone. And it just becomes this big problem with the movie. And that's probably the biggest thing that I don't like here, is the fact that the movie itself suffers from everything that's gone wrong, rather than looking at it through the lens of everything it got right. And I think on an emotional level, on a character progression level, on really even a storytelling level, I think they got all of that right. And when a movie's over and I'm not ready for it to be over yet, that's how I know that they've sold me on what's going on. And that's where I was watching it again tonight. Like, I knew that it was over. It's like X-Men Dark Phoenix. I like to say this because everyone gives me crap. But it's like at the end of X-Men Dark Phoenix, when they're playing chess, like, you know, it's over. Like, you know, this is the end of the movie. You know that this is the last time we're going to see these characters. And in my brain, when I'm watching this, I start just quoting Shia LaBeouf, right? No, 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 no. Like, I'm not ready for it to end. And I think selfishly, I'm not ready for, like, to move on from the Snyder characters just yet. Even though I like trolling the hardcore fan base, I still really like that stuff, but I do also think that it is time to look past it all and to go, yeah, it's over. It's done. It's okay to start getting excited for like the Batman 2 and, you know, the Joker 2, and then also Superman Legacy. I think we're going to see some really cool movies out of the franchise in the next couple of years. And we're just going to have to look at this as just a segment in time when these stories existed, but now they're no longer going to be what we see continuing.
Yeah, I think that, you know, it's going to be to the extent of, it's interesting because I think that we're going to look back in a couple of years, even this film. I always say that, you know, it's fascinating to look at film in the here and now, and then 5 years from now, and, you know, what it's,
All right. Well, no, I appreciate you coming on, man. I really appreciate that.
No problem.
We will, I'll be doing these more often, opening up the call lines and everything else. I just want to keep it under an hour tonight.
I understand.
Thank you so much for coming on, David. Really appreciate that. I know Mo's in the back. We'll get Mo on next time. Thank you. So, all right, everybody. The Flash is a movie that had just a hell of a development cycle, a hell of a time trying to get done, but it's here now. It's its own thing. Yes, it has a lot of problems. Yes, it has a lot of baggage, but I think it does do the best it can. And it's a movie that we can sit back, I think, in a year from now and really look at it and go, this was a good, fun time. And once we can get past the what ifs and just enjoy it for the piece of media that it is, it's going to be a lot better. But anyway, guys, thank you all so much for hanging out with me tonight. If you're listening to this on the podcast, please go and leave it a review if you can. If you're listening to this on the YouTube live stream or just catching this on the replay, please do me a solid and leave a like and leave a comment. Recommend me a movie you guys want me to watch. Recommend me a movie you guys want me to watch and talk about, and I will gladly do that. I'll see you guys next time for Podio Commentary. Have yourself a great night, and peace out.